While writing to Robert Bridges, the poet, about spelt from Sybil's leaves, Gerard Manley Hopkins refers to the essential oral quality of his poetry, a quality that he is saying is a key to understanding the rhythmical nuances of his own creative process. Here's what he says about that poem. Of this long sonnet, above all, remember what applies to all my verse, that it is, as living art should be, made for performance, and that its performance is not reading with the eye, but loud, leisurely, poetical recitation, with long rests, long dwells on the rhyme and other marked syllables, and so on. This sonnet should be almost sung. That from Christopher Wilson, writing in Comparative Literature. He wrote about Gerard Manley Hopkins, S.J., who is seen as one of the great poets of the Victorian era. We might wonder if Hopkins' verse is so very musical in its essence. How might a composer even consider setting his poems to music? Do they need it? Stephen Sammet's award-winning composer and conductor suggests that in selecting a text to set, he will not choose one if he's unable to bring something more to it, to open it up somewhat with what he hears there. And so, when he chose to set The Wind Hover by Gerard Manley Hopkins, he's given us this musical rendering. And we might ask, what possibilities did Sammet's understand were here in this already sound-rich sonnet? One important clue is given by Hopkins himself when he explains what he calls underthought in a letter to Alexander Bailey. In this letter, Hopkins identifies two strains of thought running together and as if counterpointed in poetry. One is overthought, which is, Hopkins says, that which everybody, editors, see. And the other is underthought, which is conveyed chiefly in the choice of metaphors, etc., used and often only half realized by the poet himself. That from Fiona Vance. And then there is the space a poet leaves for a keen composer, the underthought of the poem, the implications in those words, phrases, rhythms, and rhymes that aren't even consciously recognized by the writer. While countless critics consider various interpretations of The Wind Hover, Stephen Sammet's setting of the sonnet transcends those quibbles and serious questionings and lets us experience the energy of the kestrel in flight, the falcon. And, dare we say, something of the bird's ecstasy. I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dapple, dawn, drawn falcon, in his riding of the rolling level underneath him, steady air. And striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of the wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Stephen Sammet has been the longtime Ronald J. Ulrich Professor of Music at Lehigh University in Bethlehem and Artistic Director of the professional a cappella ensemble, the Princeton Singers. He's prepared a concert program that allows us to experience the give and take, the conversation between words and music, that is titled When Morning Comes, featuring poetry of Emily Dickinson, John Keats, and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, set to music by Elliot Carter, Paul Salerni, longtime colleague of Dr. Sammet's at Lehigh, Earl Kim, and Stephen Sammet himself. The Lehigh University Music Department will present the concert with the Princeton Singers this Sunday, February 16th at 4 o'clock in Baker Hall at the Zollner Arts Center on the Lehigh campus in Bethlehem. We had a chance to speak by phone with Dr. Sammet about the Princeton Singers and how they met each other.
The Princess Singers are now in their 41st season, and I'm in my 26th. So I've been with them quite some time. And the origin story, actually, is I was sitting down to lunch with a friend of mine, Margaret Ann Butterfield, in New Jersey, and she sang with Princeton Singers, wonderful, wonderful soprano. And she said, oh, we're just finishing up a search, and you would have been great, you know, that kind of conversation. And then she said, send your stuff in. And I did. And for whatever reasons, even though it was past deadline, they brought me in, and it was a love at first sight. I just thought this was a great group. And they had sung my, I've had singing. They kind of knew who I was a little bit. So we went from there. And the Princeton Singers in those days had been, the founder was John Bertolo, and a wonderful musician, still having a great time in Britain. He was an expat here. He was the choir director at Trinity Princeton and did a lot of British music, did a lot of Victorian music, Renaissance music, but primarily Latin and English sacred music. And my mandate was, can we do more things? So they now sing in 20 languages. They've done pieces from, you know, Andalusian Mushawat to Japanese pieces about, I mean, just everything. We've just covered the map. They do John Cage. They do new pieces, of course. They've commissioned. They were, for many years, the choir in residence for the Lehigh Composers Forum. So they're just used to reading a lot of new music at this point and doing a lot of different styles. And I would say their real touchstone is their versatility, which I am very proud of, that you can throw anything in front of this group and they will come up with a beautiful musical rendition. And it won't all, the color palette is such that, you know, a Renaissance piece will not sound like Brahms, will not sound like, you know, a piece of mine. So lots of different colors, approaches, a lot of imagination. And, you know, at this point, they're just up for everything in terms of the adventure. And that's why I think this upcoming concert is so great. There's three world premieres. There's pieces of Earl Kim. There's pieces of Paul Salerni. And it's really a marriage of text and music. This is really a tribute in many ways to Emily Dickinson and her voice, and then adding some other voices like Keats and Coleridge and William Say Smith, who was the first Native American poet laureate in our country, and Gerard Manley Hopkins. So it's unusual in some ways for Princeton Singers because it's all in English, which is great, but it's really about how to give voice to so much beautiful poetry.
And I would say that you and I have talked about that for many years, and your sensitivity to text and how you go about selecting texts to set for yourself as a composer. Tell us then about the way your Emily Dickinson piece came about.
Well, I would say this piece started from a commission that I got from Eileen Wesko, who, for people in the Lehigh Valley, Eileen is very well known. She's a pianist and organist and has been an integral part of the Lehigh Valley art scene for decades. She's now 90. And for her 90th birthday, I wrote her a piece on Emily Dickinson texts. And Eileen is a deep reader of Emily Dickinson. And she kind of knitted together lines from various poems, and it turned into this kind of small cantata about late love. And it's a little autobiographical from Eileen's point of view. And there will be a pre-concert lecture, incidentally, on Sunday the 16th at 3 o'clock, if listeners would like to come. And Eileen will be talking about her choice of the texts and commissioning, along with Bob Bowsmith is coming to talk too. He's also a person that can talk about commissioning pieces. So the community is very much present in this, because I feel like, you know, when people in the community commission pieces, there's ownership that is beyond me and beyond what's on the stage. It's really spreading out into people in the art scene are supporting the arts and creating new music with us, co-creating. And I just love that. So I'm so thankful that Eileen started me off on, well, we've got these Emily Dickinson beautiful texts. What can we do around that? So, of course, I started thinking of all the pieces I know that could complement this new work, this world premiere of Eileen's called Late Love. And the first place I went was Elliot Carter, who's in the 30s, set two Emily Dickinson texts, Musicians Wrestle Everywhere and Heart Not So Heavy as Mine. And these are brilliant. I mean, Elliot Carter was one of the great minds of the 20th to 21st centuries, and These pieces aren't done that often. So those, of course, came to mind. And then as I started to fill in the program, I do what I often do, which is think, oh, there's a hole in this program somewhere. I need to write a piece. And much of my programming and writing is about, you know, oh, I need a piece that feels like this in this spot. So after the Carter, and kind of quietly, I thought we need a kind of wild piece. So I sat down and I wrote a setting of Emily Dickinson's Wild Nights, which is her... I mean, we think of Emily Dickinson as this kind of quiet voice sometimes, but Wild Nights is her most overtly sexual poem. It's wild nights where I was ye, wild nights should be our luxury, and, you know, I but more tonight in thee. It's a hot poem. And we just read through this with Princeton Singers last week, and they're going to be great. But it's a very, very wild ride. And so that was how that piece came to be. It's just I kind of thought that would fit into the scope. And similarly, there was a place in the program that I just needed something a little whimsical. And I sat down and set Emily Dickinson's The Bee, which is a poem which is just about looking at this very industrious bee going from flower to flower and touching on what she calls their velvet masonry. And then as he leaves victorious, he tilts away to vanquish other blooms. So it's this kind of heroic, you know, little bee with going around and doing his job. And it's a very sweet little setting. It's a very whimsical little setting. So the three premieres on this are the Bee and Late Love and Wild Nights.
And Stephen, before we move away from Emily Dickinson, we know that sometimes readers don't know what to make of the dashes. How does she help you write or set? Do you work against her versifying? What kinds of considerations do you find at the forefront when you're considering a text of Emily Dickinson?
Well, as with almost all texts, I consider, do they sing off the page? Is it something I think I can set? So if I don't think it sings to me in some way, I'm probably going to be a little bit hesitant, or it's going to take time. It's interesting, a student of mine from the 90s, we're going back a little bit here, he turned to me and said, you should be setting Emily Dickinson. And I hadn't at that point. And there's a reason I hadn't at that point, because I couldn't quite get the melody. And the dashes are kind of, they suspend time a little bit. So, and it's interesting because, you know, in later editions or in earlier editions, people edited those dashes out. And then they went back to look at her own manuscript and they went back in. So it's interesting when you kind of see some things that don't have it and some things that do. But it's a very particular rhythm to her poetry. And I think it's only now in my later years that I'm beginning to feel like, okay, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can catch the melody here and offer something. Because obviously, as a composer, if you don't think you're going to enhance the text in some fashion, there's no point in setting it. You want to open the world up a little bit differently than other people might have through whatever musical, you know, offering you make. So it's an interesting thing at various points in your compositional life. You know, this sings to you now, this sings to you then. I guess it's like almost everything else in our lives, acquired tastes. But I felt like now I'm kind of getting it.
I just talked with Paul Salerni, and he's getting ready to screen the documentary on Earl Kim. And you have something by Paul and something by Earl Kim.
Yes, and it's wonderful, I think, when you can program a student and teacher relationship, because how do those voices contrast? Earl Kim, of course, one of the great 20th century composers into the 21st century, and Paul and his wife Laura Johnson have been advocates of Earl's music, and lately, as you probably went into in your interview, there's a new film about Earl Kim that they've been very much involved with. And I'm involved in the sense that these pieces called Some Thoughts on Keats and Coleridge were actually premiered at Lehigh University. So my relationship with Paul and with Earl goes back into the 90s when Earl was on campus with us and he brought these pieces and the Lehigh Choir was the premier group. So I feel very connected to these. And Earl has created this pastiche of lines either from Samuel Taylor Coleridge, from his Frost at Midnight, or four lines from John Keats, his Ode to Psyche, or the Ode to a Nightingale, or Shed No Tear, and the last one is To Autumn. And these are pieces that he dedicated to his teacher, Roger Sessions. Earl also studied with the much more famous Arnold Schoenberg. So he was writing to Roger Sessions, particularly the poem about autumn, when he said, "Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music too." And that is directly to Roger Sessions. That even though you were not as recognized as some people of your generation, you have your music too. So these are very much a tribute to a teacher. And of course, Paul Salerni, so much of his work is a tribute to Earl. So it is wonderful to see students so honoring their own teachers. And these pieces are miniatures. They're quite quiet, but they're so masterfully still, I would say, about very, very minimal use of harmonies, but very beautiful harmonies. And it's kind of woven into this, I'd say, 5 or 6 minute little cantata on Coleridge and Keats texts. And then Paul's piece, which is an area premiere, we're back to Emily Dickinson settings, which of course is one of the reasons I wanted to do all of this Emily Dickinson, is I wanted to include Paul's piece, which he wrote for Amherst. He said, "I sing to use the waiting." And that's a very interesting text because it's about, we're not quite sure what she's waiting for. Is it the person that's about to come, or given that it's Emily Dickinson, is it about mortality? Is it death that's coming? But the idea that she is singing, that she is using that anticipatory time to create art or poetry, you know, that that's what we can do with our lives. That while we are, you know, everything is prelude. While we are waiting for something to happen, we can be making creative acts. And I love that poem. So I'm so glad that Paul said it, and that will be our area premiere, also included on this concert. It's again, somebody who was so enamored of text that Earl would so love the poetry of Beckett. And, you know, the whole concert's about this marriage of words and music, and Earl's a great exponent of that.
And you know the hall so well, Stephen. Tell us about the sound of an a cappella choral concert in that hall.
Oh, Baker is a wonderfully warm sound for singers. And I don't think it's going to be telling a tale out of school too much. When we first opened the building and I brought the Lehigh Choir down, very first time we were in Baker Hall, and I put them on stage and there was a sophomore who was doing a solo. I don't remember actually the piece. And I went out in the hall, you know, about midway out in the hall. And I was listening to the choir, listening to this, you know, very nice baritone sophomore. And I thought, I know you're not that good a singer. But the hall was making him sound really good. And I thought, okay, we're going to be fine here. It's a very, very warm and nice reverberant kind of space for singing. And we were very fortunate to have that.
Tell us a little bit more about what we might experience in the pre-concert lecture. What kinds of offerings would Eileen and Robert?
Bob Bowsmith, yes. So we're having a pre-concert lecture at 3 before the concert. I'll moderate it. I'll talk a little about writing new music, but I really wanted to talk about how new music gets created, because it's not just a composer sitting in a room with a pencil. I mean, that's certainly a big part of it, but it's so much about community, and it's so much about people that might be in the profession, but might not, who just feel like advocates of the arts. So Eileen, of course, has been a vital part of the music scene in the Lehigh Valley for so many years. And she's commissioned Paul, she commissioned Larry Lipkus, she's commissioned me here. And she's a wonderful pianist, wonderful organist. And people know her as a great musician and an advocate for the arts. And it's wonderful that as she is 90, she still wants to be commissioning pieces and creating art. I think that that's just a kind of message about life. But Bob Bowsmith, who graduated in 1980 from Lehigh, went on to a very wonderful career doing IT and creating new companies. And I mean, not making his money as in music, let's just say, but has been an ardent advocate. And he's commissioned pieces. He is now the president of the board at the Hartford Symphony. He's supported other choral groups. He's commissioned pieces for me and other people. And I just wanted to get the message out to our community and also to our Lehigh students who may go on to careers that are not in the profession, but they can be very supportive of the arts in the way that Bob has been. And I just wanted to kind of have people have a chance to get to talk to people who've done this, and they may get inspired. They may say, I want to commission a piece. It's not that hard, really, especially if you've got some friends. You can do like, you know, five people get together and they each put in like a couple $100. You've just paid for a piece from a composer, maybe. I'm not saying that's what a piece from a composer would cost. You'd have to talk to any individual composer. But the point is, it's not that hard. And then you have this wonderful piece. And contemporary choral music is really the most performed of any contemporary style of classical music. It's very hard to get a piece for orchestra performed, especially more than once. But choirs like it, and they say, oh, new piece, you know, we can do this, and we have 16 people, and we could do it. So there's a lot more access, particularly through choral composition, than people understand, that you could commission a new work of art, and you could make it a present for somebody, or you could make it a benefit for somebody, or you could just help a composer, because, you know, that's a good thing to do. And there's composers all around. So that's one reason why I wanted to have that pre-concert lecture, was just to talk about the creative process and how we can all support that.
Stephen Sametz, award-winning composer and conductor, who has been the longtime Ronald J. Ulrich Professor of Music at Lehigh University in Bethlehem and artistic director of the professional a cappella ensemble, the Princeton Singers, whom we're hearing here. Dr. Sametz speaking about the concert program When Morning Comes, featuring poetry of Emily Dickinson, John Keats, and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, set to music by Elliot Carter, Paul Salerni, Earl Kim, and Stephen Sametz himself. The Lehigh University Music Department will present this concert this Sunday, February 16th at 4 o'clock in Baker Hall at the Zollner Arts Center on the Lehigh campus in Bethlehem. There will be a pre-concert talk at 3 o'clock. And for more information, zollner.cas.lehigh.edu, zollner.cas.lehigh.edu. And you can check Dr. Sametz's website, which is stevensametz.com, stevensametz.com, stevensametz.com. In addition, the program will be presented on Saturday, February 15th at 6 p.m. at Trinity Church, Princeton. For more information, stevensametz.com.